This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Sir Walter Raleigh never set foot in North Carolina. He certainly never saw the city that was named for him. But there he is at airport cemeteries all over the city, statues of his likeness all around the area. Why? Why does Raleigh have such a hold, Sir Walter Raleigh, on the popular imagination? My next guest will help us separate fact from fiction and perhaps answer that question. Christopher Armitage is a professor of English and comparative literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he's currently compiling a book called Literary and Visual Raleigh, Writings and Visual Reproductions of Sir Walter Raleigh. Christopher Armitage, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So tell us about this. I mean, how did the city get named for a guy who never, you know, set foot here?
Well, he did invest a lot of his money. In fact, bankrupted himself several times in sending out layers of colonists who either were subsequently brought back to England or, in the case of the famous Lost Colony, simply got themselves lost. So there's a lot of investment, literally, financially, in his involvement here. But it's certainly true that he never set foot in North America, though he certainly did in South America. And in fact, there's a rather amusing illustration of this misunderstanding, because in London, right beside Westminster Abbey, there is a beautiful little church, St. Margaret's, in between Westminster Abbey and the Houses of Parliament. And in it, not only is there most of Sir Walter Raleigh's remains except his head, but there's also a very fine stained glass window on, excuse me, on the west side of the church. And it shows Sir Walter stepping ashore at Duck or Manteo or somewhere, as it would later be named. This was donated by the American friends of Sir Walter Raleigh, who were clearly not well informed about the historical facts, but it is a very nice window.
That's pretty good. It shows you how easy it is to get a window made, I guess, back in those days with your image on it. So who was this guy?
Well, he was a very outstanding, flamboyant Renaissance figure. If the idea was that in the Renaissance, if you wanted to be somebody of distinction, you had to master, as John Milton says in his Essay of Education, all the arts and abilities of peace and war. And Raleigh certainly did that. He was a soldier, a sailor, a navigator, a poet, a historian, a courtier, etc., etc. So he was certainly the fulfillment of the ideal of the all-around person.
How did he come to the attention of Queen Elizabeth, and what was his role in court?
Well, he was disadvantaged in this sense, that he was the son of his father's third marriage. So he was a long way away down in Devon, not only geographically, but literally from inheriting any of the family fortune under the system of everything goes to the firstborn, primogeniture. So he clearly decided that his way to the future would be to go to London, to the court, which was, I suppose, about the equivalent of going to Washington in order to get ahead in the United States.
So he starts hanging around. But I'm trying to figure out how you even do that. You get an audience with the Queen, you wink, you...
Yes, that's right, you get noticed. Now, certainly, Raleigh was a man who would get noticed. He was well over 6 foot tall, which was very tall in those days. He was also striking appearance and had a kind of dynamic air about him, a hustle and an energy which attracted attention. He also knew how to dress himself stylishly.
Great hats.
Yes.
Great
hats, beautifully trimmed beard, expensive clothing, which he was willing to sacrifice, according to the famous anecdote, which is probably untrue, of laying his cloak in a plashy place as the Queen, sailing down the River Thames, was stepping ashore and might have muddied her clothes in the mud.
Wait. You mean you think he didn't really do that?
No, I'm sure he didn't. There are lots of reasons for that. First of all, the story only got into print about 50 years, 40 to 50 years later in the 17th century than the persons involved were long dead. Secondly, it is very unlikely that the Queen would have been travelling, as it were, so casually, mingling with the crowd, and in spite of the enthusiasm for her as Queen Gloriana, etc., etc., that it would be very dangerous for her simply to walk out into the middle of an unknown crowd. I mean, she wouldn't have limousines of CIA men protecting her.
Right.
So the very circumstances are questionable, and then the fact that the story didn't become encased in legend until long after, decades after the event, although there is this about it, that even if it wasn't true, it should be, because Walter was a man who was very willing to make a shrewd sacrifice, and throwing down an expensive cloak of his for the Queen would certainly be another gesture which would endear him to the Queen.
And even if it isn't true, it suggests that this is the kind of guy you want to make up that story about. What was it about him that made these stories in the air so long after he was? They may have happened even?
Well, by then, of course, he'd acquired an enormous reputation, even though to say that he was generally popular is dubious. He had a lot of enemies at court. In fact, everybody at court had a lot of enemies because of the pecking order and the ambition, not to mention the greed, of rising to the top in the only place where you could rise to the top, unless you were a very well-established family figure with a big inheritance up somewhere else in England. Raleigh obviously was not that. So his energy, the fact, for example, that while still a teenager he had gone off to France to support the French Protestants in their struggles against the Catholic powers in France, culminating, of course, in the infamous massacre of the Huguenots on St. Bartholomew's Day. Now, Raleigh was the sort of young man, he would still have been a teenager, who went and fought on behalf of the Protestants. This was his kind of commitment, the same, of course, in his many expeditions against the Spaniards. But these are the sort of things that attracted attention to him.
Now, another myth, I think a myth, is that Sir Walter Raleigh was the man who introduced tobacco to England.
Yes, well, that is certainly historically disprovable, because tobacco had already been brought to Europe and was spreading around Europe before his time. This is another wonderful anecdote, that supposedly, while he was sitting in his garden, one of his servants thought he was on fire because he was smoking from a pipe and rushed up and threw a bucket of water on him. Now, this again is the sort of story which quickly circulates, gathers a currency about it, but is really most unlikely to be factual.
The servant just thought he was a jerk and decided to douse him and came up with a pretty good excuse. But you know what's interesting to me about this is that this is this threshold and in certainly English society and European society when, as you say, the route to the top really went through the court. There was a pecking order there, and that's about the only way unless you were to inherit land. Aha, but there's a new route to wealth now, and that involves trade, it involves money, it involves commodities. And Walter Raleigh is a guy who picked up on this pretty quickly, I guess, huh?
Well, yes, and he saw that this was the age of the beginning of colonialism and colonial imperialism, and he was willing to ride with that. He had, quite early in his mature career, sailed with his cousin, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, on an expedition to get to North America. Sir Humphrey Gilbert, although a well-known navigator and a seaman, a captain, had had to turn back. Raleigh kept going and got hundreds of miles further across the Atlantic before he, too, returned. So this kind of willingness to commit himself, to finance expeditions, to go on fighting campaigns, especially against the Spaniards, these are the sort of things that marked him, along with his physical height, his clothing, his style, his panache. All these things helped to build up this prominent public figure and therefore helped to make enemies for him.
I'm wondering whether a guy like him, or sort of in that period where, again, power had to do with your position, your rank, and then this discovery that money could have a lot to do with it, if he was, if people sort of in those early days were more interested in reputation and adventure, or they really wanted lots and lots of money, which at the time was had a different kind of value than it does today, didn't it?
Well, indeed. And this, of course, is the age R.H. Tawney's famous book, Religion and the Protestantism and the Rise of Capitalism, that money was becoming more important, and clearly money could be obtained by venturing out from Western Europe into the Americas, into Asia, and bringing back successful commercial enterprises, establishing them. And Raleigh certainly tried to do that, not only by attempting to plant colonies on what was to turn out to be the coast of North Carolina, though at that time it was known as Virginia, in honor of the Virgin Queen, but later, of course, got these divisions of state titles, but also his attempt to find the City of Gold. If the Spaniards had made themselves the dominant country in 16th century Europe because of looting Central and South America of its gold, transporting this gold back by ships across the Atlantic to Spain, they might worthily be subjected to some competition. And Raleigh, on the idea that somewhere in South America there was the City of Gold, El Dorado, and so he went to look for it early in the 1590s, travelled through the jungle, and was to come back and write a very effective piece of propaganda travel literature about going up the River Orinoco in what today is Venezuela, and not actually... The gold was always round the next bend, as it were. The city was always just one river further. Of course, it wasn't there, but even so, he came back and wrote this very effective piece of prose, one of his many successful publications, The Discovery of the Rich and Beautiful Land of Guiana, with a title that goes on in the current style for about six lines, in which he recounts all his meetings with the natives, persuading the natives that if they only took on this benign monarch, Queen Elizabeth in England, they would not be subjected to Spanish tyranny, and so on. And Raleigh sells all this in a package. Now, this, mind you, was in the early 1590s. The book, The Discovery of Guiana, is a book of 1594-95, when he was, as it were, at his second wave of attempting to establish himself as a major figure in court, as he had done in the 1580s, and then shot himself in the foot by his secret marriage.
Well, tell us about his romances and whether or not there was any romantic involvement between him and the Queen, and whether that was somehow involved in his...
I don't think so, partly because the Queen was far too cagey and knew how to advance a new presentable male, not only English noblemen, but various candidates from the continent, because this was an age when you aggrandized your nation and your crown by making alliances with other crowns from other nations. So the Queen had a considerable number of suitors, all of which she was very, very clever at playing off, stalling, procrastinating, putting them off so that eventually they just folded their tents and went away. And Raleigh had risen from the early 1580s, been accorded all sorts of awards by the Queen. He'd been given the grant of the funds to be obtained from the sale of wine. He had been granted the money to be gained from the tanneries, the tin mines in Devon and Cornwall, his native terrain. He had been made governor of Jersey. That's not New Jersey, of course, but the island of Jersey off the French coast, which is still part of the United Kingdom. So she had bestowed all these titles on him, and because of his height and physical presence, had made him captain of the guard, her own personal guard. So there he is, building all this position and advantage and power in the 1580s, until at the end of the 1580s, after already having got involved with other ladies, he makes a secret marriage with Elizabeth Throckmorton, who was one of the Queen's ladies-in-waiting. Now, one of the things about being a lady-in-waiting at the court of Elizabeth was you were expected to be in waiting. If the Queen couldn't marry, you better not marry either. But unfortunately, of course, Elizabeth did succumb to Sir Walter's style and dash, did marry him secretly. The Queen, of course, was livid when she found out, had them both thrown briefly into the Tower of London, and then kicked Sir Walter out of court and sent him back to Devon, where he languished for a while until he rebuilt his stature gradually in the 1590s and was much better placed again when the old lady finally fell off the perch, as they say, at the beginning of the 17th century. And being the Virgin Queen, the whole question of succession came up, and that's how the Stuarts of Scotland got invited down to become of Kings of Scotland and England. But that's
the Stuarts of Scotland is the subject of our next program.
Oh,
thank you so much for being with us. Fabulous book. I've got about 30 seconds left. What was your biggest surprise in the research so far?
Ooh, Raleigh's capacity for recovery and remaking himself, remodeling himself, even when King James, who was a vindictive enemy of Raleigh's from the very arrival of James in England, who got him under a sentence of death on trumped-up charges of being an ally of Spain. That's like saying Ronald Reagan was a member of the Kremlin. And so Raleigh falls from grace, spends 12 years in the Tower of London, eventually is let out again because James I wanted more money. Raleigh said, I'll get it from you from El Dorado. Goes back a second time. His son is killed during the second expedition. He comes back and gets his head chopped off publicly with great style and grace. And amongst the people listening to him were the men who founded the English Revolution in the 1640s and 50s. And
I'll have to have you back to find out who got the hat. Okay. Christopher Armitage, thanks so much for talking with us. Christopher Armitage, Professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The forthcoming book, Literary and Visual Raleigh, Writings of and Visual Reproductions of Sir Walter Raleigh. And that's the state of things for today. This is coming to you from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.